The Accidental Entrepreneur is produced by Beinhacker Law and brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors. One of One Productions, the New Jersey-based podcast studio that produces and edits both audio and video podcasts. They sell equipment for the average podcaster and have even created a guesting kit exclusively for our listeners. North Authentic, the conscious hair care marketplace offering the cleanest brands from around the world. The Healthy Place, the e-commerce site with thousands of supplements to help you live a healthier life, along with natural solutions for chronic pain, stress, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, and much, much more. And be sure to support the podcast by ordering some logo merchandise from our online store. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
And then from that, that kind of just pivoted my entire life. So since 2013, I've now dove deep into the kind of the entire structure of how to run hospitality at the highest level. And we've come up with some value tenets, training processes, and a vision. Since that day, we've done 5 mega turnarounds. And I mean mega, like spend millions of dollars to buy it, spend even more millions to fix them up and reposition them, and then install our own operating companies, like our own management company,
right,
and run them. We've ended up showing up at a top 25 hotel for multiple years in a row on TripAdvisor out of 55,000 American hotels. We're in the Wall Street Journal, all this. Okay. And all of it comes down to the way we treat the guests. So at first I thought it was about the building.
Right, and that's why you call it the hospitality industry.
Oh, yeah. That's why I call it hospitality.
Yeah, you didn't notice that. Yeah.
Yeah, because
you shift from that. We were talking about construction development. You said hospitality, and I knew there was a reason for it.
Yeah, hospitality is the ministry it's you
the,
do.
That's
yeah.
the sales sizzle, right? No, nobody, anybody has a – they could think your hotel's beautiful. If they have a bad experience, they're going to tell every one of their friends that they shit – you know, well, you have a beautiful hotel, but they treat you like crap.
Yep.
Or, you know, it wasn't the nicest place, but boy, did they treat us like – we were like kids.
I know.
You know,
we always said you can actually get a 5-star review at a bad place if you're treated well. So wait a second. That means the people experience, the personal experience is actually will trump your emotional reaction to the property.
Yeah, it matters more.
So that's when we became this awesome training company, and we teach that. And so that's kind of why we've succeeded. And then later, as my partnership with that gentleman came to an end, I was able to start a big community of investors. I found out about this whole world of private investing through private placements and private funds. And then we learned that there's hundreds and hundreds of people that would like to own these tax benefits, major cash flow, and lifetime perpetual equity.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode.
Hello, my name is Josh McCowan, and proud to be a father of 10 children, married 24 years, and today I get to serve the investors of Accountable Equity as the president and CEO. We put together these private real estate funds, buy resorts, cash flow, and provide direct access to the benefits of real estate for hundreds of investors worldwide. And I'm just so grateful to be on this show today.
All right, Josh, so I appreciate coming on the show.
Thank you so much,
Rich. We've been spending like a whole day together. We've all had lunch and laughed and talked about a lot of stuff. And I'm always excited to talk about, you know, real estate, because that's like the hot thing. Everybody wants to invest in real estate, but it's not for everybody. But maybe we could go back, because my show is often about like your background and, you know, what your expertise is and how you got to where you are. There's always a story that goes with that. So maybe we could go back to, I don't know, it was college or before college or whatever.
Oh, nice of you. Thanks.
Share your story. Probably people don't ask you too much.
First of all, it's an honor to be here because not too many people take the time to hear people's story. So thank you for that, Mitch.
No, you're welcome.
46.
Okay.
And I grew up here in, well, we're actually in New Jersey today, actually recording live at the On Air Brands. But I grew up with my one brother and my little mom, who's handicapped, in the area around west of Philadelphia, so in Norristown, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And we grew up in the 80s. I always say it was, I think my career as an entrepreneur began as a paperboy, or before that as a scrapper.
They still have paperboys anymore?
They did.
Do they have newspapers still?
No, I know.
Now they don't, right? Well, they do. Something hits my driveway. I don't know who's delivering it.
Yeah, who's delivering
it? There's no kids on
nobody
bicycles anymore.
No. And by the way, whoever doesn't know what that was like, it was so different than you would ever have imagined. We were basically independent contractors. They would give us a bunch of papers, and then we had to go get our own pay by knocking on grandma's door.
Yeah.
And we had to, like, knock on everybody's door every 2 weeks and get the money, and then we could siphon off our portion after we pay them.
Yeah.
Crazy.
No,
crazy
you wouldn't pay on the internet automatically. You had to leave an envelope. I remember we used to get an envelope.
Yeah.
We'd have to leave it for the paper boy.
Yeah.
Well, this is the 80s. Nice, it seems like it's the 60s.
Yeah, I like the way you left it for the paper. I had to knock, come back. With these little piece of paper tabs you had to rip off.
Your $2.95 for the month.
Yeah, it was like $2.95.
Something like that.
You had to hope there were some tips. But, you know, fast forward, I think my quick career and life story goes from that. Always really looking to figure out how to make it a little better or build some side money.
Okay.
So paperboy then became a dishwasher. And then ultimately I went to college and became a teacher,
ironically.
So I became a teacher and I studied theology and civics and history.
What were you teaching, high school?
Yeah, taught high school after that.
You got to have a lot of patience to teach high school.
Well, I only made it 1 year because I don't have the patience that is needed for that. It's just not pleasant. Sorry.
It's definitely a thankless job, I got to say. You know, a lot of these teachers take the brunt of, especially nowadays, parents and stuff like that. Oh, jeez.
Yeah, that was
You said you have 10 kids?
I do. So that was 1997 when I was a teacher. And I imagine it's worse now. But back then, it wasn't that pleasant either with the, you know, navigating classroom discipline.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so where'd you go to college? Did you go in Pennsylvania?
I did college in Franciscan University of Steubenville. It's out in just as you get past Pittsburgh. It's in Ohio.
Got it.
If you don't know Western Pennsylvania, you get to Pittsburgh and you're pretty much at the end of the state. And then all of a sudden you're in the beginning of Ohio. And I was like 45 minutes from the Pittsburgh airport, though. Very close to the state.
Yeah, because West Virginia sticks up there. My son goes to Indiana. We lived in Columbus for a while. You go through Pennsylvania.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yeah, we lived in like 98 to something like that. A couple of years. I worked for Nationwide over in Columbus.
Yeah.
And never seen anything past. I thought the world ended at Pittsburgh and it started in LA, you know?
Yeah.
But as you're driving there, you're all of a sudden in West Virginia. There's like this weird part of the state that sticks up, right? And then it's like 10 minutes and then you're in Ohio.
Yeah, that's exactly where we were, right near that tiniest portion of the top of West Virginia.
There you
that's
go. Right. Wheeling or something, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I see the signs when I drive out to Indiana. My son's a senior there. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so and I've heard of Franciscan. So you got a business degree there? Or?
I was going to, but then I had a really deep conversion to my faith, and I wanted to study and become a teacher. So I ended up studying history and theology as degrees, and then education as like a certification. So I ended up with what would be equivalent to 3 bachelor's degrees, and then later went back for my MBA. So yes,
after
I do have
gave
my
up
MBA.
The teaching.
Yeah, I gave up teaching, went back. And was able to get a job as a recruiter, like a student recruiter, admissions. And then when you do that, the best hack you can find is you get free tuition. So that's when I got my MBA.
Got it. So was that at Franciscan? Or
was it actually. I started there, but I actually got my MBA ultimately in Michigan at Eastern Michigan University.
Yep.
And I definitely thought that was a great.
Franciscan wasn't cold enough for you, so I wanted to go further north.
Yeah, Michigan, As a matter of fact, I was not far from Detroit. So
yeah, Michigan's
tough parts of the world.
Yeah, you got East Lansing, right? Ann Arbor, Detroit, the
very
whole area.
Very close to Ann Arbor, yep.
Got it. Okay, so then you came out, you got your MBA, and what was your first job after
that?
Well,
I was working that whole time. We were married.
Okay. Yeah.
Started to have our first child, and so I was working while I was doing the MBA. Then we got this cool opportunity to through the university network, I was able to get a gig back in Europe.
Oh.
And work at a picture Austria Europe, which is where Maria von Trapp was singing with the Sound of Music. And,
yeah.
and we were in the foothills of the Alps in a town called Gaming, ran an old monastery, turned into a hotel,
wow.
turned into a school while I was there. We had the school students. Did that for 4 years, barely came back to America, spent most of the 4 years in Austria, learned my Ein bisschen Deutsch, you know, small bit of Deutsch.
Some of your kids were born there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three of them.
Had to be.
Two
you have
them,
10 kids. I mean, you're only 46.
Yeah, two of them were
you're
born
doing
there.
The whole time. Yeah.
So we were all three. We came back with three kids from Europe. In 2006, we got back to America.
Yeah, you like the Von Trapp family.
Got we were.
Kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what brought you to, well, take me along the path. So how did you end up in real estate?
Yeah, thanks.
Because now you really run an investment company that invests in real estate.
Well, it was 2006.
Yeah.
The economy was cranking in a good way. It was going well. Houses were obviously the hottest things to talk
mortgages
about.
Mortgages hadn't crashed yet.
Mortgages not crashed. So I knew at some point in my young career, I knew I wanted to be a real estate developer.
Okay.
I mean, just a passion for it. I always wished I could have been that. So,
like construction? You wanted to be on the construction side?
I did. I always joke that I grew up without a father, so this old house taught me how to be a man.
Right.
And this old house taught me how to be a handyman, and Bruce Willis and Die Hard taught me how to be a man.
It was true.
My two jokes.
The only problem with this old house is it would take you a lifetime to do the project. You'd watch an episode and they'd put like in one piece of lead pipe above the toilet. That'd be the whole episode. And you'd go back 6 weeks later and there's nothing done to the house.
That is true, man.
Right?
It was real time, bro.
Yeah,
They were in real time construction.
Get shit done, you know? That's.
Ironically, I still love this old house. And yes,
Can you find it on TV? Probably dead a long time, right?
Bob gave up a long time ago.
Yeah.
There's a younger guy who's doing it for like 15 years. But I still love that show. I actually went up to see some of the houses.
The houses?
Like,
that
about 6 years ago, I took my kids.
That was
up.
Fascinating, me renovating a house. We've had some old houses too, but, you know.
I love the historic restoration part.
Yeah.
I really like keeping it so you can't tell and have it all flow organically. And
yeah. Yeah. Okay. So.
But so what happened was we came back to America knowing that the real estate market was at its all-time high, or we now know it was at its all-time high.
Right.
And we knew we wanted to get in there. So instead of, I didn't have a direct path. So we brainstormed. I had reserves of cash. So I said, well, maybe the best way to get into real estate development is become a lender.
Okay.
So I became a lender, right? You know, that doesn't take too much background, just, you know, kind of
just
good.
Privately?
No, I mean,
go into
as a regular mortgage
get a
lender.
Job.
I got a job.
Okay.
Yeah. I came back from Europe, got a job.
Learned the mortgage side
broker.
Of the business. Okay.
And learned how a mortgage works. We don't have to get into the works. I learned how you originate a mortgage, but then ultimately the originator sells it right away.
Yeah.
And then a different bank holds it. And I started being a little bit surprised how that all worked. But none of that was what I was really, really worried about. I was worried about learning how to secure debt to build buildings. And so constantly I was spending time with developers, you know, putting myself out there. And finally, through some chutzpah, found a developer who hired me. And hold on a second.
I did not know that was on.
That's okay. Well, now your phone's charged. There you go. We're good. I like, real life.
Hey, I'm back. So if we're picking up there, I don't know. I don't know if we're
going to
cut into that. But
yeah, whatever.
Bottom line is we succeeded. One developer liked our chutzpah. I had put a few business plans together about projects.
Okay.
He hires me on the spot. I leave mortgage, join him as a project manager. He's in the middle of building a bunch of $5 million flips.
Right.
It's 2006. Now we're going into 2007.
So you're going around managing the subs
His
and the whole thing.
Yeah. It. And what was happening back then was the GC, who was supposedly an expert builder, was in such demand back in 06 that you would hire anybody who said they were a GC and had a small license, which isn't hard to get.
Right.
And we had one of those guys that should have been doing one house at a time because these were multi-million dollar houses and he was trying to do four.
It's too much for him.
He was ill-equipped. So he would barely be at the project. So I would be the project manager for a few of these special $5 million houses. He wouldn't be there. Contractors would be there. At the end of the day, I tended to step right into the GC role slowly but surely. How's the trim going to go up? I need interpretation of these plans.
Well, let me ask you the structure of the deal. So if you have the developer, right, and you were the manager that worked for the developer, and then you go out and hire a general contractor, you guys weren't the general contractor?
Okay. I do think it's always good to, even if you do it all yourself, to separate the skills and the processes. But in his world, he was in capital. That my partner was the capital of his own projects. He would buy land, speculate on really good waterfront land in New Jersey. Then he would hire a third-party general contractor, and then he would stay on top of that general contractor until the building was built, and then he'd sell it as a spec house, which is the most
risky. Yeah, it is.
It's the most risky.
Right.
But it avoids the idea of having a family in there trying to
Change everything you want to do. Make some of these guys crazy.
He would furnish it and sell it
at
a high, high price. And that was his model. And it worked for many of those years until it didn't work. But while it was still working, I built, I think, 4 houses as project manager. Clearly, I got there midstream on some were at the beginning. And I ended up learning how to be a general contractor.
Because you almost took over for the GC,
GC, by the way, at that time, he had metamorphosized his company into he actually had the GC company. So by the time I got there, he now had hired a full-time GC in-house.
Who worked for him. Got it.
So that guy was reporting through me, with me, but was never there. You know, so I was there. And I ended up becoming a pretty good builder as far as like anything to do with basically setting expectations and schedules with contractors and giving them advice. You know, when you're building a $5 million house, couldn't be more different than a track house. I mean, every piece of trim is supposed to be integrated and thoughtful. And
it is different expectations. They're paying for high quality work.
And, you know, plans are good, or maybe the ones we bought were good, but they still left a lot of interpretation. So there was a lot of thinking.
That's where all these lawsuits come from. I had some big ones I've been a part of.
Oh, that's true. That's your background, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a litigator, but I did have a client once who was he's a doctor, and he was building a house, and I got him the financing at one point. I checked in with him like, hey, how's everything going? This was like a couple of years later. He's like, I don't even want to talk about it. I'm like, what do you mean? You're not living in the house? Like it wasn't. So I brought in an owner's rep, and we terminated the contract. It was a big lawsuit, and we had to get a lawyer involved in that. Then we brought in a new manager that took over the project, and you know. But I learned a lot of the stuff about, like, if you have a house and the piping is, you know, supposed to be a certain thickness, if it's an L and it's supposed to be an M, that's a big deal when you have a 10,000 square foot house. It may not be a big deal when you have a tract house.
Yeah.
But, and he would catch these things all the time when they're trying to, you know, the windows show up in their vinyl replacement windows. And he's like, what do you mean? I'm building a $4 million house. What the hell? Oh, that's more money. And this guy would be upcharging him all the time. It was a mess. But yeah, I understand how it gets crazy, because you want specific finishes, you want things done a certain way. And this wasn't even a spec house, but you knew that if you were going to get the buyer to come in, your spec house had to be, you know, really up to, you know, high quality.
Yeah, we kind of looked at him as, honestly, he was a wealthy gentleman who was he actually, this was his passion. Now, he made great money at it, but he had a real passion for it. And he actually shared that passion with me. I kind of adopted it. I already had a natural love for architecture and buildings. Lived in Europe for those 4 years. I used to give tours of ancient buildings.
Oh, so really?
I really loved, you know, the types of architectural capitals and how symmetry can be uplifting to a building design and all that stuff. So I really enjoyed it and became quite skilled at it. And then, you know, just to finish the story, what happened was the recession came.
Right.
After the recession, there was a period of time where we were trying to figure it out, like, should we keep going? He ended up shutting his company down. I went and found a way to buy a franchise. So by buying I thought, well, I love being a manager. I love being an entrepreneur. And I'm going to buy a franchise. And I thought, you know, I love the
building business and the construction.
Kind of.
Okay.
Peripheral. I went out shopping for franchises in 2009 thinking I need to find something that's going to be recession resistant.
Right.
And I thought the way you're recession resistant is if you buy things that are regulated, like you have to do them. So I went and found one that and if it's recurring. I thought if it was recurring bill, regular.
Sure.
So I bought a business that cleans restaurant hoods, believe it or not.
And wow.
Which is as bad a business.
There's a franchise that does that?
Yeah. Yeah. Early on, I was one of the early ones that bought in. And boy, was that a lesson. I learned a lot. I lost the business, which is helpful to my overall growth, but frustrating for years.
Was it a problem with the business itself? Was it a problem with the franchisor?
It was probably me, and okay. The franchise system may not be as good as they thought it said it should be. Meaning they said it would take an hour and a half to do the project at this. They had a very high standard, and then they said you'd get paid a certain amount. So, you know, all those assumptions, when they start to break,
yeah,
then you start really into trouble. Like if it takes 4.5 hours to do what they said it would take 1.5 hours, and you know, the money is still the same.
Right.
You're upside down. I actually blame myself, but I also was frustrated that there was no support on marketing or lead gen.
Well, that's always a problem with a problem. Yeah.
And I would say that's one of the best things you can learn. If you take anything from this podcast, if you're going to buy a franchise, I think most of them today are probably a good system.
Yeah.
Probably a good idea and maybe something you care about, but you have to be a salesperson.
Right.
I would not buy a franchise if I were you, if you don't want to be a great process-driven salesperson.
Right. You have to be. And I also think the support that the franchisor gives you, like you said, that's why you talk to other franchisees. What kind of support do they get? Are they on their own and this and that? A lot of these smaller ones, apparently you can franchise anything these days to get people to buy in if you're a good salesman.
Yeah.
You know.
So
but it was a learning experience, right?
I mean, I lost it all just because of sales. Basically, what happened was 6 months of ownership, thinking I'd hired a salesperson, thinking I was owning a company and managing other things at the same time. And then 6 months after that of being the salesperson, one time at beginning we were selling on price, like, oh, we'll do it for less and do it better. Then that failed us. We could barely get contracts. People weren't willing to transition from their current provider with that promise.
These were like commercial.
They were.
These are restaurants mostly?
Literally every single restaurant that cooks with a hood above it.
And there are some competitive businesses in the area that already do them.
Yeah, and they do them badly. So the theory was you can replace them, but still the devil you have versus the devil you don't know.
Yeah, people do that all the time.
So I kept saying, but we'll do it really well, but cheaper, and that just wasn't working. It wasn't until our back was up against the wall, and we went after the biggest contract, like a couple $1,000 cleaning or $1,500, $1,500 compared to $3,000 cleaning, and we basically didn't back down on price, and that actually won respect with that vendor, ironically, and then we did perform. So because we performed, because we were confident and quality assurances were in place, they gave us their gig and all their other restaurants, and many, and then they gave us references to all the big restaurants. So we went from absolutely terrible performance for 6 months, like almost no contracts,
right,
to full slate every week, full. Problem was the company wanted all their back pay. And with me being a small family, a business, we didn't have the capitalization after losing money for 6 months. So tons of lessons there. One, sales are sacred, we say. You know,
right.
You can't keep these things open if you're not going to focus on the sales. And then two was we definitely did not have our eye on the ball the first 6 months. So we've tried to use that lesson in all the ventures we've done since. Change our ways.
Okay, so you got out of that. I guess you couldn't sell it, right?
No. Yeah. We gave it back to him.
Yeah.
Gave it back to him. And then, from there, we ended up, how we got to where we are today. We years later, a couple of years after that, after doing consulting for a while.
In the real estate business?
I actually consulted in marketing, meaning I built a small marketing team and I went out and sold our services fractionally to a technology company in D.C. And really, we were pretty good at email. We basically self-taught ourselves some skills. I mean, I had the marketing MBA, so I had some background.
Right.
And we institutionalized. So now, fast forward, we get into what we're doing today because of a cool pivot that happened in 2012. In 2012, my old partner, my old friend, boss, became my partner in this new, he and I, he's like, listen, we're not going to flip houses anymore.
This is the guy building the high-end homes?
Yep. Oh, I'm not going to flip houses, but I do own this hotel. What should we do with it? I said, I don't know. Let me go down and look at it. And it was at that time, he had hoped to tear the hotel down and build condos back in the day.
Okay.
But now it's the slow, the economy
was
awful.
Nobody was condoing, yeah.
Yeah, so he's like, I'm not tearing anything down.
Right.
So I said, well, let me fix it up and we'll turn it into a prototype and we'll fix up hotels. We'll be hotel flippers. And we'll use your your property as the prototype, and then we'll do this up and down the Eastern Seaboard because there's a ton of dumpy beachfront hotels.
That you would buy, renovate, and flip.
That was our theory.
Okay.
That was our theory. So I fixed this one up, hired a management company, and it went – the construction came out beautiful. We changed the style to mid-century, blah, 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 blah. We did all kinds of cool things. But we handed it over to a third-party manager. They came with great references, and they crashed and burned.
Ugh.
So poor guys, poor team, and poor us. You know, I always joke the F word was the most common expression at the front desk. So we ended up having to build a management company the next year. You know, he owned the asset. We built this management company together. And then from that kind of just pivoted my entire life. So since 2013, I've now dove deep into the kind of the entire structure of how to run hospitality at the highest level. And we've come up with some value tenants, training processes, and a vision. Since that day, we've done 5 mega turnarounds. And I mean mega, like spend millions of dollars to buy it, spend even more millions to fix them up and reposition them, and then install our own operating companies, like our own management company,
right,
and run them. We've ended up showing up at a top 25 hotel for multiple years in a row on TripAdvisor out of 55,000 American hotels. We're in the Wall Street Journal, all this.
Okay.
And all of it comes down to the way we treat the guests. So, you know, at first I thought it was about the building.
Right, and that's why you call it the hospitality industry.
Oh, yeah, that's why I call it hospitality.
Yeah, you didn't notice that. Yeah.
Yeah, because
you shift from that. We were talking about construction development. You said hospitality, and I knew there was a reason for it.
Yeah, hospitality is what is the ministry you do.
That's the sales sizzle, right? No, anybody has they could think your hotel's beautiful. If they have a bad experience, they're going to tell every one of their friends that they shit. You know, well, you have a beautiful hotel, but they treat you like crap.
Yep.
Or, you know, it wasn't the nicest place, but boy, did they treat us like. We were like kids.
I know.
You know,
we always said you can actually get a 5-star review at a bad place if you're treated well. So wait a second. That means the people experience, the personal experience actually will trump your emotional reaction to the property.
Yeah, it matters more.
So that's when we became this awesome training company, and we teach that. And so that's kind of why we've succeeded. And then later, as my partnership with that gentleman came to an end, I was able to start a big community of investors. I found out about this whole world of private investing through private placements and private funds. And then we learned that there's hundreds and hundreds of people that would like to own these tax benefits, major cash flow,
right,
and lifetime perpetual equity. But how could they? How could you possibly be able to go buy this resort?
Right. You can't.
So we take a fund, we raise $5, $10, $15 million. We go out and buy resorts. And everybody who's with us as an investor, actually, this is the part that I think most people don't know. It's as if they bought the resort from the tax code perspective, meaning they get a
depreciation, K-1, the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, your listeners might know that stuff, but you know, I didn't even know. I was building the resorts, operating them. We were succeeding, great cash flows.
Right.
And you know, the heavy lift of how the tax savings was working was I just missed it.
Right.
Then I became I went off to create our own fund, hired great CPAs.
But like, when you say it's a fund, it's really not a fund. It's more of a syndicate, right? Because a fund would be like I own shares in the mutual fund, and sometimes I may pay taxes without having any money or whatever. But you're saying that I would be an actual owner of the part of the company, and then the real estate benefits flow through to me as an owner, just like it flows through to you as an owner.
Right.
Okay. And you're doing, these are leveraged deals, I assume, right? So if you're, so it might be, you know, $50 or $100 million deals.
Not yet. No? Just so you know, our strategy so far has been pretty distressed, early, you know, relatively distressed, meaning getting them at an affordable price, but spending more fixing them up than we bought them for.
Okay.
So we can usually get into them for $5 to $10 million.
So these are smaller deals, a part of the market that's kind of ignored by.
Right.
The REITs and the exactly. You know, the what's the one? What's the big REIT with a V? Vorheim? I don't know, whatever. There's a lot of big REITs out there, but yeah, they're looking for bigger deals because they got more capital deploy. And if they did $10, $15 million deals, they would spend their whole life looking for deals. They're
That's
too
right.
small.
Yeah, you did just identify a key indicator as to where this niche is that we're at. Now, we look for drive-to resorts. Now, our resorts are physically big. I'm just buying them on the cheap, like 240-acre golf course,
So they're resorts. They're not motels. They have other resorts, things that go with the building.
Yeah, and a resort is super cool because you control your destiny with a resort, meaning what we've done is – I'll give you the numbers on one. We bought one for $5 million in New Jersey out of bankruptcy. It was 240 acres, 120,000 square feet, 55 rooms, a golf course, and the second oldest winery in American history. It probably – on paper, should have been $19 million.
Yeah, I was going to say, $5 million sounds like you got it for free.
I did basically get it for free. So then we put a syndicate together, but it's really a fund. It's an SEC-exempt fund.
Yeah, and you have to be an accredited investor.
You have to be an accredited investor.
Okay, people can look up what that means. We're not going to get into it.
Yeah, so – but a lot of people are, you know. So your bottom line is we bought it for affordable, but then we had to keep investing in it. So here's how we built the business, though. You might say, well, it doesn't matter if you get a building for free. It doesn't matter. Can it make you some money or not? And
right.
Can you get a value growth? And here's how we make money. And this is actually, grab your pen and paper. And this is the secret sauce. Not only do we have the culture, which allows us to perform at a high level, and we train every week and all that good stuff, but it's we sell weddings at our resorts as an overlay on top of the entire project. So we are very good at that. We focus on that. We spend money on the marketing. We spend money on the salespeople. And in the last 2 years at that property, just the one property, we've sold almost $21 million of contracts on weddings.
And they're profitable.
Very profitable.
Yeah,
and then you take $21 million of cash flow and you overlay it on a building you only bought for $5 million. Yes, of course, we invested in the building.
But that's capital improvement. You're increasing the value of the property. It doesn't matter. It's on paper.
I mean, we estimate 4 to 5 times we've appreciated within 2 years.
Wow. Yeah, because if you're reinvesting, if you say, yeah, well, we got to put money into the building, but in theory, that's raising your equity.
Yes, it
should.
It is.
Yeah, I understand.
It is. So our investors benefit, you know, because they get that little preference every year, which is can be up to double digits. And then they're getting the tax-free situation, usually depreciation's far offsetting any income. And then they're sitting there, and you might say, well, what's in it for them? Am I going to flip this hotel? Technically, we're perpetual holders. And the way we're going to capitalize them and give them back their money is with that debt strategy.
Yeah.
These are mine.
Borrow the money out and pay them off.
We're going to borrow the money back out once it's worth the money. So give us 3 to 5 years, we always say. And we're right on pace with that, even through Corona. So we've been completely successful through Corona because we're not actually Marriott and Hilton. Marriott and Hilton depend on you and I going on business trips and filling their hotel. That is still way off, as you know. There's just a lot less business trips and a lot less conferences.
Did Marriott get bought by that big group, Bonvoy or something? Or
no, Bonvoy is there. Bonvoy is there. As far as I know, Bonvoy is the name of their rewards program.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Looking to get into podcasting? Maybe to market your business, for your own enjoyment, or because you have a message you want to get out there. One of One Productions is a New Jersey-based studio just over the George Washington Bridge that caters to the booming business of podcasting. They offer a comfortable atmosphere using the latest technology available to record your podcast. And they are a full-service media company offering both audio and video production services, creating both audio and video podcasts, as well as video shorts for business and personal use. Professional audio equipment packages are available through their website for all budgets, and be sure to check out their podcast guesting kit created specially for our listeners. Care for your health. Care for the planet and look flippin' great doing it. North Authentic is a conscious hair care marketplace offering the cleanest brands from around the world. Their pro stylists curate only the most fabulous non-toxic hair products with better-for-you shampoos, serums, masks, and more that actually give you gorgeous hair without hurting your health or the planet. Hey, you've only got one life, one planet, and one glorious mane. Might as well treat them all as best you can, right? Try a 100% clean hair care routine prescribed just for you using their link in the show notes. If you don't see a big, beautiful difference in how your hair looks and feels, you can tell them they're crazy. Do you battle chronic pain, stress, anxiety, or depression? Well, if you take any supplements or you're interested in natural alternatives, you need to know about findyourhealthyplace.com. Find Your Healthy Place has thousands of supplements to help you live a better quality of life, as well as natural solutions for chronic pain, stress, anxiety, depression, sleeplessness, and much, much more. Need guidance? Use their live chat feature and talk to a wellness consultant right on their website. And be sure to use our coupon code TAEPODCAST for all your purchases to get the best prices at findyourhealthyplace.com. Follow their links in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
Oh, okay. Those commercials are misleading then.
They are. They're confusing. So they are still down. We actually started to grow and surge. So we went from a measly $5 million revenue, $2.5 million revenue a couple years ago to $5 million during Corona to $16 million this year. So our growth path of revenue is just astronomical. And it's because we kind of benefited a little bit from the anti-hospitality trend, meaning we're eclectic. You come to us, there's a lot of space, a lot of outdoor activity. We're in drive-to from New York. You don't have to get on a plane. And so during the Corona, we've grown and we've attracted so many investors because of it.
Well, I would think too. You said drive-to. Nobody was leaving this country.
Nobody was leaving this country. So we benefited from all that.
It was a boom for you guys. Yeah. So what kind of total returns are
average? Good question.
What does it happen deal to deal on average?
You know what? The way we do it is I think just for those of you who have never heard of this model, I have to admit there's – I wish more people knew. This is the world of private investing. This is what the billionaires and the millionaires do in the family offices. And thank God people with accredited status can now also do it.
Right.
Where our returns are usually double digit. So it depends. It depends how much you invest.
Cash on cash and equity increase.
Yeah. So we do a preference.
Okay.
Just since
it's like a dividend.
It's like a dividend. Okay. Since you guys are listening to this great Mitch is an attorney, and we'll do it a little more complicated than I would on a normal podcast. But you buy into a fund, you're the actual owner that owns the real estate, so then all the passive at losses go to you. So year one through three, we tell you the best we're going to do is the preference. So you might have bought, you might have invested at $25,000 was the original low. Now it's right. $50,000. And that preference, you were buying a type of class of equity that came with a 6%. If you wanted to put in $100,000 or $200,000, you would get up to like 7 or 8% preference. So you're buying equity, but you're getting benefits by keep putting larger sums in. It's better for us.
Okay.
Then your goal is to just be that we keep you covered on those preferences for the first 2 to 3 years while we spend the money on construction and do the turnaround. And then by year four, you're starting to get that plus distribution of profit. Then by year five, we hope that the refinance is possible and you get either most, if not all of your capital back. And this is going to mind blend for most of you. Now, hopefully you have your money back by sixth year. And now you're still getting probably a double digit calculated cash on cash, even though your cash is back. See, it's very mind bending because if your money comes back to you and you're still making what would have been 10%, it's actually called infinite return at that point. And this is what the rich do. They buy assets. They then pull their money back out later with collateralization, and then they perpetually make money. So
you're saying that
it's exponentially better.
Your owners stay in the deal
forever,
even when they get bought out.
Yes,
even when they get their capital back.
Yeah, that is mind bending.
Yeah, that's not 10% on your money. That's like you can't measure the return when you have no money in the deal.
Thank you.
At that point,
you get it.
Yeah.
Now you have to wait.
That doesn't include the depreciation also that they got flowed through.
That's true. I don't calculate that. Some people in my position do. They'll say it's a calculated return.
Well, they're just grossing up the return. Yeah. But that depends. You don't know what their tax bracket is and everything.
What they do in those, just so you know, I've looked into that. They'll put an asterisk saying assumption of this kind of tax
bracket. Assume you're in this. Yeah, right. Whatever. It's all sales bullshit.
All I know is I didn't know that was available. I don't know. It's as if you were about buying properties. A minute ago, you said, real estate's not for everyone. I agree. There's two types of big. There's real estate active, meaning you go find a house, flip it and keep it, or flip it and rent it.
Right. And there's passive.
And then there's this.
Yeah.
And then way behind me is REITs.
Yeah.
Okay. So doing it yourself, you might make a lot more than double digit. You might make 100% return in 3 years.
You may also lose a lot of sleep.
Yes, you'll definitely lose a lot of energy because you'll have to do it.
A lot of stress.
Then there's what we do where we are your worker bee, but you get all the tax benefits and about a double digit return. And then there's the REITs over there that do not come with as many tax benefits that we do. We actually literally can offset your income with fake losses. I call it fake losses, but it's called passive losses, paper losses.
Yeah, it's not fake. government lets you.
I know. So fake is the bad word, but I'm literally.
It's fake because the government made it that way.
It's amazing.
It's legal.
It's
why real estate's so great.
I can't even tell you guys if you haven't seen this before. Say you're a very wealthy dentist and doctor, which is the majority of our investors. You probably don't know this unless you've bought a private real estate deal. You literally will get a negative income on your tax return. It'll go negative $5,500.
Right.
You'll be like, but I got a $9,000 check this year. Why does it say negative 55?
That's what you save in taxes.
So you pay no tax on that $9,000 you got.
Yeah, I know.
It's shocking.
People miss that.
It's shocking more people don't. I mean, that's why the growing group of people that invest in things like me, and we have 272 active investors, and they're usually high-earning salespeople from technology, real estate investors themselves that don't want to do any more deals. And there's a certain group of people out there that have bought so many real estate deals that now on they just buy what we do and they have no work to do. They just collect our checks basically.
Yeah.
And then there's the, dentists and doctors. That's the majority.
Yeah, because they don't know what to do with their
money.
Or
lawyers, because of course lawyers, dentists, doctors, CPAs can make good money but get really hurt on taxes. So you need other ways to make money that don't get hurt
on taxes.
They're
in very high brackets.
Yeah.
Yeah, very high brackets. Yeah, I definitely have interviewed a lot of people. Some of them do flips and their own stuff, and they like doing that, and they have a crew, whatever. But for the average person to say that, I want to get into real estate, you're much better off going the passive route. I mean, you
trade off a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a guy – remember, have you ever heard of the show Bigger Pockets?
No.
Big real estate podcast.
Okay.
One of the guys on there is a phenomenal – he articulates things very well. And he said, think of investing, no matter what you want to talk about, as the level of risk you're willing to tolerate or the amount of people involved in it is going to lower your return. So, if you buy the house yourself, whatever the return is, you made it.
Yeah.
For us, it's us and you. There's not like 17 other people behind me. You're buying the equity from me, the builders.
Right.
Then there's buying the equity from a REIT, and you have the entire monstrosity of a REIT in front of you before the property gets, makes you money. And then, of course, Wall Street, there's literally brokers on top of brokers. Then there's the stock, and then there's the company that sold the stock. It's just a lot of layers.
Yeah.
So this is about as good as it gets unless you really want to get your hands dirty in real estate.
Right, because your level of risk goes down too, but your return. But in your case, they get almost direct investing and all the tax benefits, but they get your expertise.
Yes.
And which
it's like
they,
your
they'll
worker
spend
piece.
A lifetime going to develop.
Yep.
They'll have to make all your mistakes.
Yeah, we made mistakes, but now I think, at this point, we found a niche. We found this niche. Of course, we're ultimately buying legacy resorts. I mean, the one we bought in Annapolis area, which is on Kent Island, 240 acres on the water, 222 actually, on the water, 1.7 miles of waterfront with a marina. Bought it for $5 million.
That's your sweet spot. You like to buy them for $5 million.
I do like $5 million right now. I do, and there's a third one I'm looking at for $5 million. Ironically, right now that is weird. Yeah. And then, the appraised value tends to be 20 to 30 within 2 years.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know what it is? You might say, how did you do that? It's just because in commercial real estate, this is another surprise that most of you who've watched a bunch of HGTV don't know. Houses are valued. You buy a $100,000 house because it's all beat up, but the house next door is worth $250,000. You could fix up the $100,000.
It doesn't matter
house.
What you put into it, right?
It won't. It'll probably. You could probably get it to $250,000.
Pretty
right?
close, right? But if you put in $400,000, it's still going to only be worth
$250,000, right? But commercial, it's about how much cash,
right?
And you said it right. And I don't know if we all know that. So how can you buy a $5 million building and make it worth $20 million?
Increase
you
the income.
Sell weddings.
Yeah.
And then weddings drop profit.
Right.
And bankers look at the profit and they say, scheisse, business is and building is worth this much.
No. I know some guys that, they buy garden apartment buildings or they buy larger apartment buildings and they raise the rents like enough.
$100.
Enough that they're not going to move. But because there's so many units, and then their cap rate goes down and then their value goes up.
That's fancy stuff. You're fancy. You got a great audience that knows all the words.
I don't
like
know
cap
if
rates.
They do or they don't. I just know I like the real estate
cap rates.
Side of it.
Yeah, cap rates.
So do a lot of people roll? Maybe that's not the right term. So you're buying them out. Let's say you're refinancing.
Oh, okay.
Do they roll into a new deal now? A lot of people.
Honestly, so far, every time we've done major distributions, people tend to invest in what's currently
the
going
next
on.
Thing on the table.
Yeah, right. Because we've been pretty successful. We've launched and raised all five. We've run five different funds, and we've done various types of things. This is for another show, but because we're resorts and we have so many pieces of equipment, The government loves when you buy pieces of equipment.
Yeah.
Because they let you depreciate it 100% this year.
Yeah.
So a lot
it's
of my
6,000-pound vehicle.
That kind of thing, or any kitchen equipment or anything that makes money, golf carts. So
that
things
could all be depreciated because it's like a business equipment.
It's a piece
or
of equipment.
Right?
And the government lets you take that all the way to zero in 1 year right now. So I'll put together funds of $1 million, buy all the equipment the property needs.
Yeah.
Next on the docket probably is golf carts because we spend money on them. We spend a lot of money on renting them. Why not just own them? Or what I do is I basically put a small leasing fund together.
Uh-huh.
And that lets the people like you and I who want to get depreciation, we want to put $50,000 in and get $50,000 back in losses.
Right.
And get 10% on our money. It's magic. It's like – it's magic.
Well, it's, you know,
it's using the code.
And yeah.
It's exactly. Just using the tax code for what it was built for, putting money into the economy. Really. Yeah. That's what we're all doing. It's funny. There's people that get mad at the people who don't have to pay these taxes. But we're actually doing it by following the code. And some people say – well, then was the code written to get you to do that? Yeah, I think it was.
There was some wealthy people that said we want to have advantages of the real estate and stuff. But it also – it benefits the economy to do
that. We went from – this business used to have 40 staffers. Now has over 225 every day. They're making a lot of money, thank the good Lord. You know, our gratuity-based people are making extremely high gratuity because everything's going well. And then our salaried people are paid well. And so we've created a big boost to the economy.
Right. Well, I mean, if you couldn't – depreciate things and you couldn't do exchanges and stuff like that, the amount of money you'd pay in tax, it would destroy it wouldn't keep the real estate business or the real estate values growing and stuff like that. Now, do you do or can you do cost segregation
and
stuff like that? You do.
Well, man, you're sophisticated. You're doing over everything. You would think this is a real estate show.
I got 10 years on you. I've been doing this for 30 years.
I know, but this is not a real estate show. Yeah. I'm so proud of you.
So explain what cost segregation is.
So for those of you guys who are listening to this, I have a visual that if you want to think of this, have you ever – I call it the golden carousel. So if you want to start building some wealth and you have some in capital over there in Wall Street and some in Wall Street bonds and stocks, you could choose to keep it there, but there is no tax advantages to that.
No.
Or you could move that $100,000 and put it into your first horse on the carousel. Buy things that are assets, the way the wealthy buy them, the way the family offices buy them. The asset's going to go up in value with inflation. So you're going to start benefiting from inflation. And it's going to throw off losses for a period of time while it's throwing off cash. Therefore, the horse is getting started. It's kind of going up, making cash, but now throwing off losses. So it's you're paying almost no tax on
because
that
there's more tax deductions than there is income.
And then you take the whatever profits you're making on that horse, buy the next horse. In each year, you're going to need to buy a horse for the carousel. So there is a catch 22 here. There is a catch. If you want to follow the IRS code, pay almost nothing in taxes, do what the economy needs you to do, which is put people to work and do all that as a passive investor, you will need to acquire one new asset or more a year. Why? Because as assets are giving you cash but losing their depreciation because they're burning it off, now they are going to cause tax problems.
Right.
But if you go and buy things like this equipment fund I've created,
right,
next year, it's only going to give you $10,000 off of $100,000. It's going to give you 10%. But it's going to give you negative $100,000.
Right.
So now it's going to offset everything you had bought last year. So last year's money still comes to you tax-free this year. If that doesn't make sense to you, I always just kind of call it a carousel because each year you're buying another horse. They're going up and down. And if you buy the right type of horses, real assets and depreciable equipment, you can actually follow the IRS code to the T. Almost like they wrote a roadmap.
Yeah.
And you do it and you win.
Yeah. Okay. So, but let's explain what cost segregation is.
Yeah. Cost seg helps make sure.
Down.
So you buy a $5 million resort.
Right.
About 30% of that, and there's an engineer that'll show up at our building, we'll pay them money for what is called a cost segregation. And what this is saying is that an engineer and a CPA are going to actually measure the building and evaluate what of the $5 million, how much was dirt.
Right, because they're going to break down all these systems.
Dirt is not depreciable.
Right.
Then they're going to say, how much is infrastructure building? How much is ground improvements? How much is equipment? And they're going to say, for equipment, it's a 5-year depreciation. For this type of other stuff, it's 15 years. For the building, it's 25 years. And then for the dirt, it's no depreciation.
Right, well, because you always have the dirt.
And by doing that cost segregation, what you're doing is you're saying, you're putting it in writing. The IRS wants you to do that. And then your CPA takes whatever it's usually between 25 and 30% of the $5 million is going to be called immediate bonus depreciation.
Right, so it accelerates the depreciation.
So it's going to take the $5 million and make it possible for you to write off $2 million this year. Now, here's where it gets crazy. If you use debt to buy that $5
million, okay,
you might have only written a $1 million check.
Right. Still get the full depreciation.
But you still get $2 million in losses. So you actually—
That makes sense because you still own the building. You just posted it as collateral. Yeah. So basically what—
That's
so
a mind bender, everybody.
If you didn't cost segregate the building, you would have to depreciate the whole building over 25 years,
yes,
right?
Right. Yeah. So it would go slower.
Which we know present value of money. You want it up front.
You want it up front. Wow, and you're good. This is a very high—
You're not in these deals for 25 years, so you don't
want to depreciate. We are. We actually are perpetual holders.
Right.
But— you know how you'd follow the IRS code on that is you use debt refinances.
And then that resets your depreciation?
No, but it depends on your CPA's interpretation, but it comes to you as a debt.
So if he doesn't have a good interpretation, you fire him and you hire a different one?
I'm not here to talk about that. I'm just saying. Funny thing is guys, close your eyes for a second. You're at your house. Your house went up by $100,000 this year in value. You decide you want to buy a beach house and you want a $100,000 down payment. You go and you pull a HELOC loan out of your house,
take $100,000 credit. Yep.
And you took $100,000 cash today. You literally put it in your bank account. How much did you pay in tax?
None. You owe it back to the bank.
Same thing with the business.
Got it. That's what I love about real estate. There's so much you can do.
I hope people who are listening to what you and I just said.
Yeah.
Is not known by 99.9%.
That's true. Well, that's why most of the real estate's owned by like 1% of the country.
But that's what I'm so grateful about, the democratization of our business. Literally, people are getting all of what I just told you.
Yeah.
But
they don't have to know about it or worry about it.
So the funny thing, though, is because they're resorts and they're awesome, you can look them up. One's RenaultWinery.com and one is Kent Island Resort.
Okay.
And our company is accountable equity, two words, accountable equity. And then you'll see everything we've done and histories and stuff. But what we went and did, I hope you're sitting down, Mitch. We said for the investors who are going to join us, they're regular good people like us. They're not fat cats in Wall Street and they're not family offices necessarily. They're smart people that have made money but need to learn the tax strategy. So we do a quarterly free mastermind and we bring in keynotes. As a matter of fact, you met the next keynote, MC Loucher.
Oh, he's coming?
Yeah. Okay. He's a big investor too, invested in multiple funds. So he'll be a keynote to 100 plus of our investors at their resort. I mean, the emotional—
at the resort that they invested in.
Yeah.
That's fun.
It's a kind of a holistic experience. It's very uplifting.
Yeah.
Because you start to realize my money, put that dude to work.
Yeah.
Fix this building up. I'm making money this afternoon because there's enormous amount of weddings going on and food and beverage going on. And my wife and I are now understanding how the tax code works so we don't have to give away all our money in tax.
That would actually be pretty cool to be an investor in a resort where you get married. I don't know how many young people have the money. But so I have two questions for you. So I have two questions for you then. Is there a minimum investment?
Not much. I mean, listen, it's not that much. A lot of times people pull their IRA money out and invest that. So it's not even money.
So you could do a self-directed IRA?
Yep. It's like $50,000 is the typical equity position.
Okay.
Launching this year, we'll do some really cool debt funds. So instead of owning equity forever, you're going to get a perpetual debt check with annual abilities to liquidate it. So if you put in 50 grand and you want 50 grand, it'll probably get like 7 or 8% yield.
Okay.
Every year you could pull your money out. You have to give us your notice. And that there's those types of nice, solid investments through debt or equity. Equity is usually 50 grand. Debt's usually 10 grand.
And do you work with any particular companies to put these self-directed IRAs together, like Guidant or any of these
companies?
Or people do that on their own?
They do that on their own. We advise on a few. Like if you don't have one and say you have your money in an IRA and you haven't looked at it for a while, you can usually move it to a self-directed IRA. So right now it might be at Vanguard or something.
Yeah.
And it's 250, 500 grand. You could move it to a company. The one we've often recommended is Camaplan, local to here. A lot of investors from Camaplan. And then it's like you deposit your money with them and then
they do all the setup, though. Yeah, handle all the compliance and everything, because I don't do that.
That's how it works. Yeah. Now, Mitch, you may also want to learn about the 401k, the solo 401k, and teach your clients about that, because that's even better than the IRA.
It's like a SEP IRA, but you can put more money in.
Yes, it's a SEP IRA, but you can put more money in and you have more tax advantages, ironically. So even though you think they're the same thing, I've been learning this past few years That there's a lot more strategies that you can
with
do.
With the 401k versus the self-directed
IRA. Now, that's 202 or master's degree level stuff. Yeah. But just realize, again, most of the world doesn't realize your IRA does not have to be in Wall Street. It can be in direct real estate.
Right. No, I think, yeah. People are starting to learn that more.
Yep.
And there was another question I had for you. It was on the tip of my tongue, and I lost it. I forget what I was going to ask you. I asked you about the minimum investment for people. And I was going to ask you, I know what my question was. So from a business standpoint, how do you source your investors? How do you find them?
You know what? We've gone down the path of organic. You know, we're on, I don't know, 20 different podcasts a year. We have a podcast, Capital Hacking. And we're not, there's no trick. I mean, I think people need to get to know our team. And one of the strategies of having meetings every quarter where investors can come.
Yeah, well, that's a good one.
Is for them to actually meet the people who run the business and the funds.
Right.
Meaning the actual CPA will be there, the CFO. Why? Because when you're investing in Wall Street, they may or may not be good people, but at least you know it's documented somewhere.
Right. Right?
When you invest in a house yourself, you know it's you and your own bank account are keeping track of it. And then when you invest with people like us, you just need to know who we are. And at the end of the day, it's us that are going to help you make money with your money.
Yeah.
So we put ourselves out there. We do a lot of podcasts like this.
Yeah. So it's content marketing, reach out.
You got to
know. I mean, outreach, direct. And you must get a lot of referrals, right? Because somebody's comfortable with you and they tell their buddy who's a doctor also and says, hey, you ought to check these guys out.
Yeah, and you know what? And even if you don't invest with us, we have this free education platform at Accountable Equity because what we're doing, there are other good people doing. As a matter of fact, I could introduce you to people that do it for apartments and people do it for self-storage. We happen to do it for the world of resorts, and I'm really proud of where we're at because we're in this drive to resort thing. Now, back to my point is we do education on just how it all works. Not because you don't have to invest with us, but I do think more good families should know they don't have to feel trapped into just Wall Street.
Right.
You might as well get a little in, a little out. Because you know what? At the end of the day, our real estate, you might say, well, what if there's a crash in real estate? Yes, there could be a crash. What if there's a pandemic? Well, I can answer both of those. But let's talk about an economy crash. As long as we continue to pay our bills, your real estate is safe.
Yeah.
So, yes, there may be a terrible wave that comes
over the economy. But it doesn't disappear. The land is still there. Yeah. The building's still there.
So do you feel more safe in something that could be torpedoed or Reddit destroyed next week? You know, you and I don't know how the Wall Street really works. Right. I don't know if anybody really knows why values go up and down. It's usually trends.
A lot of it's artificial. Yeah.
A lot of it's artificial, trended. For us, as long as we're selling something and someone's there and paying a bill, there's money to pay for the mortgage and there's money to pay for the bills.
Right.
And even as our property temporarily contracts or goes up in value, as long as we keep stable, your asset is safe. Especially if your horizon is not 1 week or 1 year.
Right.
If your horizon's 1 week, 1 year, play the stock market.
Yeah, you don't want them. But you also manage your debt load to a certain extent. Some of these developers over the years, even back in the 90s when I was working for some developers, I was in sales going in a suit, sweating my nuts off, you know, trying to – I didn't know what I was doing. But they would leverage themselves so much that when the market crashed
– They had no room.
They had no room. They just had – they collapsed and it was not good. And the ones that – did manage themselves well, got the pickings.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it?
Up the bones. That's what happened.
That's true.
You know? All right, so how can people get a hold of you? How can they find you?
I'm on every social page, so just Josh McCallan.
Okay.
Feel free to check us out. But also just go Accountable Equity is non-threatening. Feel free to fill it out. You'll get a quick info about us. You're always invited to all our free events.
They can be on your mailing list. And
you can actually even come to that in-person event. If you're interested in us, you know, so it doesn't cost very much because we don't charge our investors, but we do have a small fee for the people because we do we throw on a great party with food and beverage and you know, events.
Yeah, well, I mean, if somebody's interested in real estate investing, they should be willing to invest some money, not just time.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get into, I know we're running out of time, but how did you get into like why resorts?
Drivable
resorts versus like you said,
honestly,
buildings, commercial.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to you and I have been watching the trend with, I compare us more to Airbnb than to us to Marriott, right?
It makes sense.
Marriott is 100% because you got on a plane, you needed a hotel.
It's a different product,
Airbnb, eclectic high-end stuff, killed it during Corona, right?
Yeah.
As long as it wasn't in a city.
Right.
Airbnb assets were packed.
Right.
We were packed during the corona.
Yeah.
So somehow, some way, what we're doing is perfectly positioned for the same trend that Airbnb is doing. And we're very different than the city hotel or the drive along the highway hotel Hampton Inn. They literally have no levers to pull. If the economy starts going down, what are they going to do? Just lower their price? We actually go out and sell an event and have a concert, or we do a wedding, and we actually do a festival, a 3-month winter festival, which currently is on pace to do $2 million this year. And all it was our brainchild during Corona. Let's get people outside. Let's rent an ice rink.
Yeah.
We got ice rinks, outdoor winter concerts, outdoor fire pits, outdoor hot wine. And it is packed. We were on all the morning shows. So we have levers we can pull that a box hotel just, what are you going to do?
Right. Really are a hospitality and entertainment business. And you have a diverse employee population. You got people that work on our golf courses.
You
got people that are doing events. You got people working in hotels.
You
got
to come see it, Mitch. You got to come on down.
Is there anything nearby?
It's right here in New Jersey. It's a Renault Winery Resort. You got to see that one.
I will definitely.
Yeah, I'd love for you. I mean, and then if you want, and this is open to your listeners, Thursday mornings we train. And, you know, the secret sauce is, we have good business plan. We have very good sales process. But the reason people are in love with working with us and the reason we're in love with doing the work is something called Vive May, which is our French word for reviving the soul. Revive the soul is French and it is stylized into Vive May. Well, that is the name of our company. That's the name of our culture. And we train every Thursday on the why we do what we do, which is putting the guest and their recognizing their infinite dignity and worth and cherishing them is like a conversation with all 200 teammates every week. And we teach things like, do you know who your teammates are? And then we have a prompt part of the session where we say, we call it the who, WHO, who's in the room, who's on the team. And they have to say who they are, what they do. And they have to answer a simple question that's on the wall. Can we count on you? So they have to answer the question. And we really want them to feel free to say, no, you can't count on me. And it doesn't make you a bad person.
I would say that.
They would.
We get fired.
We would want them to resign. We always say we cherish.
And the answer is yes, by the way.
We respect you enough to let you resign and we'll give you a good referral because we got to count on you.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, so everybody gets up and shares their name and it's really hospitable. And then they'll say, you can count on me. And you know what happens is it's self-selection. I think if people don't like that kind of accountability, they'll just slowly but surely be the ones that resign.
Yeah.
Or they won't get in the door because we're pretty overt about it. If you're an exec, you're not allowed to even interview until you come to one of our teachings and trainings. And if you don't want to be part of a massive revolution in hospitality service, picture the Chick-fil-A compared to a Burger King, right?
Right.
We're and like it's that.
Chick-fil-A's not for everybody.
The way you
they're
say my pleasure.
It's too much. Yeah.
The my pleasure thing. You know that whole my pleasure and the way they're really sweet about getting you a drink? That's how we are.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to work at Burger King, you'll be able to feed us, but we may not enjoy going there. So
exactly.
We can't hire that kind of person.
Well, I appreciate you spending time with me. It sounds like you got it all going on from the customer service side to the, you know, employee, employee experience, you know, how they value your company.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's people that are working there that are happy, very happy. And I've learned through all of my interviews and dealing with businesses that is so important, especially when economy turns like it just did and people were reevaluating their entire life,
right?
They're like, I hate what I do. I'm sure very few people at your company said
we were one of those places that didn't tell you, sorry, no waiters. You know,
we never
had one of those signs. It doesn't mean we weren't struggling to get people.
Yeah,
we
were. I understand that.
But we kept it going.
Yeah.
Very strong.
Well, Josh, thanks for your time. We'll put links in the show notes. People can get a hold of you. Definitely visit Renault Winery in what town?
That's Egg Harbor City, New Jersey.
Oh, sure. Down the shore. Okay. And I guess on your website, they'll find any other places you have.
Awesome.
All right. Josh, thanks so much for your time.
Mitch.
I appreciate
you, buddy.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.